Welcome to the Best Ever You Show with your host, Elizabeth Hamilton Garino, CEO and founder of the Best Ever You Network. The Best Ever You Show is here to help you live your life to the fullest. How? Real people, including celebrities, real advice, real places, products and businesses, real life stories. With this radio show, printed magazine, websites, community, and more. And now, here is your host, Elizabeth.
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for listening today, and welcome to the Best Ever You Show. I wanted to just let you know that we have updated our website. It's at besteveryou.com. And so it's all new, all sorts of new information. And we took our old website that we've had for the past, 7 or 8 years, and it is located. I didn't move any of the content over or anything. I just put it in a holding area so you can find it if you want to. It's at besteveryounetwork.com. So all the information there is still preserved. We're moving over content. We're just sort of giving us a new look and new contributors and all sorts of good stuff. But this is our first show of the fall season, and I'm so happy to have Dr. Rajiv Pardi. I want to make sure I say your name right.
Yes,
did I get it right, Doctor?
Yeah, you did.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being here, literally. And you're a world-renowned cardiac anesthesiologist, and you were chief of anesthesiology at Bakersfield Heart Hospital for more than a decade before you had your own life-changing near-death experience. And so you're here to tell us about that and your new book, Dying to Wake Up. And for all of you listening, his website is dyingtowakeup.com. You can find him on Facebook under his name. I'm going to just go ahead and spell your name if you don't mind. It's Dr., so Dr., Rajivpardi, so that people can find you on Facebook and Twitter. I'm sure you can just Google him or go to his website anyway, and it all links together. But just in case you all want to see that while we're talking on air. But welcome, and thank you for being with us.
It's my pleasure to be here. I like of your show, you know.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I have my own little brush with death, and it sort of straightened me out as well. And so I completely understand what you're talking about. I nearly died a couple times from allergic reactions.
Wow.
To almonds and things like that. I have terrible food allergies. So life-threatening anaphylaxis and things like that. So I understand you, but our audience, everybody loves to hear somebody who doesn't give up. And you clearly have not done that. In fact, you not only didn't give up, you went full steam ahead with everything. So can you tell us what your life was like before you had this experience, what you were doing, how this all came about? You know, just give us some history about you. Tell us about yourself.
You know, basically, my life before my near-death experience, excepting for a period of when I was 17 or 18, when I became very religious, when I started medical school, like questioning what is while doing dissections, you know, this person was alive 2 months ago, somebody's son, somebody's father. Other than that period, when I wanted to become a monk, my life became very materialistic. I came to America in 1982. The spiritual or the Raj, who wanted to serve the poor in India in the remote villages, was left behind in India, and succeeding in status and in money became my only motto. So I went for the American dream, but not only American dream, but it became a runaway American dream. Like, I did a residency in pediatrics, but pediatrics is the lowest paying specialty. So I was not making the money I wanted to make, so I went back and did a residency in anesthesiology. And I moved to California because my sister was here in near Fresno. And 28 years I was in Bakersfield. I'm still in Bakersfield because my wife has a job practice here. And every few years I was building a new house and moving to a bigger house. And so was with my cars and status. Like one time I had a Hummer, a sports BMW. Every 3 years I was changing cars. And my last house was a 10, 11 square foot house, 1,000 square foot house with golf course, lake, and everything. house was so huge that we had to use with kids intercom like in the hospitals or iPhones within the house.
I was texting you from the basement.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Yeah, my mortgage and tax was about $15,000 a month. So I was working very hard to keep up with these payments. And so a stage came when I would question whether I owned the house or the house owned me. And for my stress management, if I was not on call, my typical thing was to have a drink of scotch. One will become two, two will become three. Then I'll be sleepy, go to sleep, and wake up in the morning, go to work. And when I was driving in the morning at 6:30, I would be talking to the stockbroker because it is 9:30 in New York, talking to my nurse for my first case, and also driving and eating a sandwich and drinking a coffee. So I was doing multitasking to the maximum one could. So that was a very stressful life I was leading. Then I got my wake-up call. Yeah.
Going to say, do you think that's what made you sick?
Yeah, maybe, because you know, 70% of the modern day diseases are lifestyle diseases. You know, if we lead a balanced life, you know, I'm not saying not to make money or not to achieve things, but in balance, then 70% of the modern diseases will go away. You know, diabetes, high blood pressure, you know, heart disease, all those things. Stress, strokes, you know, all those things are related. So in my case, it was August of 2008 when I got a call from my urologist that I have a good news and a bad news. The bad news was that I have prostate cancer, and the good news was that it was in very early stages. So if you remove the prostate, I'll be cured. So I flew all the way to Florida to get it done laparoscopically through buttonholes. And the surgery went fine. You know, I was cured of cancer, but it left me with complications. Few of the complications were especially incontinence, and wherever they did the surgery, anastomosis of the main tube urethra, it would scar up, so I needed about 7 surgeries because they had to do laser or cold knife to cut the scar. Now, 2.5 years passed by, and my incontinence didn't get better. Then I consulted a doctor at UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles, and he recommended that we do another surgery to install what is known as artificial urinary sphincter, which will give me control of my bladder.
Right. So how does all of that, which sounds miserable, by the way, bring you to the point, it sounds like you're okay at that point then, right? How does a near-death experience come into to play with that? Because it sounds like maybe you found a solution for what, you know, for all of the extra surgeries that you needed. Did something else happen?
Yeah, exactly. So I went ahead and got the surgery done at UCLA in the early part of December. And then after the surgery, a few days later, I started having very high fever and trembling. And the doctors put me on oral antibiotics. Then they tried IV antibiotics, strong IV antibiotics, like vancomycin, gentamicin, and I was not getting better. So they told me to fly, they told me to come to UCLA, and which is about 110 miles drive from Bakersfield. So my wife drove me there. Looking back, we should have asked for medical transport. But anyway, I was so nervous and scared that, you know, I want her, maybe this is my last night, and she was crying because it goes through what is known as Grape Point, you know, mountainous area, that,
right.
You know, if something happens, what will she do? Anyway, so when I reached UCLA, the conclusion was a urinary sphincter, artificial urinary sphincter is after all a foreign body. It had become a source of infection, and so they needed to do emergency surgery to take it out. Otherwise, it can progress to full-blown sepsis. Sepsis can go into septic shock, and which has a 70% mortality. So that's when the emergency surgery was happening. 20 minutes into the surgery, I found myself floating near the ceiling. And my first reaction was, you know, I must be hallucinating or somebody mixed up some anesthesia drugs. Because as an anesthesiologist, I know there is a drug called ketamine, which does give an out-of-body experience. And I checked the records, that was not used. And it is very, very rarely used in adults. I don't think so I ever used it in adults. I have used it in kids for burn dressing changes, and the people use it in veterinary medicine.
Yeah, my son broke his arm last year sliding into second base, and they gave him a round of that. And yeah, I completely understand what you're saying with that drug. It's a wild one. But so you didn't have that. And
no,
so,
I didn't have that.
Let me back up for just one second. So did you die in the – did you – I don't know if the medical term is die or whatever, but during the surgery, were they actually trying to revive you, or did you die, or what happened to
you? I did not have a flat line.
Okay.
You know, like one of the ways we define death is, you know, when there's a flat line. I did not have a flat line.
Okay.
And then my consciousness, I could see my body being operated, and I could hear the anesthesiologist tell a joke, which I remember to this day, but I can't repeat it because it was a dirty joke. And I realized, you know, as an anesthesiologist, part of my job is to remember jokes and keep the room entertained. And from there, my consciousness went to different realms, and one of the realms appeared to be what I would call a hellish realm. I could hear souls crying and wailing, and there was fire, there was thunderstorm. And my first question, especially being raised as a Hindu, why am I here? What have I done? And I asked for help. And the person who showed up was my father, who had died 20 years ago. And I had a very complex and difficult relationship with him. You know, he used to beat me up, you know, because he himself was abused by his father, and he was 18 years old when India and Pakistan came into being. And there was genocide on both sides. And he had to run from what became Pakistan with hiding among dead bodies. So he had a lot of trauma in his life, which he projected on my life. So he came to my rescue, but there I realized that he did love me.
Yeah, I have so many questions, but I just kind of want to keep listening to you. Is that okay? I'd love to know how you ended up there. Because most people, I guess, when they talk about near-death experiences, they talk about the light and their mother, their father, you know, someone that they know and so forth. So this is, you're one of the first people I've ever heard that says that they actually went to this dark place first.
Yeah.
What do you think that meant, and how did you get out of that?
You know, you get out of it by repenting that, you know, what I had leading so far was a very selfish, mean life that I wanted to get ahead in life at any cost. I was a technically very good anesthesiologist, but I didn't have the empathy or connection to my patients. And similarly, my father was abusive to me verbally and physically. I was not physically abusive to my kids, especially my elder son, but I started to become verbally abusive to my children, especially the elder son. And the main thing is ask for help. You know, there are divine beings like angels, ascended masters, your parents who are there to help you. And from there, my father led me toward the tunnel. Yeah.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, so he helped you. I wonder, did you have any kind of conversation with him? Did he say he was sorry? Was there any...
Yeah, you know, like it was all telepathic, that it was more a feeling transference, you know, like... But he did say one thing, that what he had told me on his deathbed, that if you keep your consciousness clear and you're truthful to your own self, the divine, the universe will take care of you. And those words I had forgotten when he died in Fresno after bypass surgery. And from there in the tunnel, I had a review of my present life. The review was in the sense of a 360-degree review where I could feel what the other person was feeling with my actions, good or bad. It was not necessarily all bad, you know, I've been good too. So what other person was feeling with my actions.
Now, for somebody listening to the show who might be like, yeah, right, you know, that doesn't happen, I don't believe it, you know, and you may have at one time been sort of like that too in your life. Tell us, maybe say, you know, give us some reason why we should believe this. And do you, I believe you because I my father, myself, I mean, I just, Anita Morjani and all these people, they sort of have this same thing in common. But for somebody listening who might not, do you feel a need to convince people, or do people have to learn on their own, or how does this all work? And do you feel, I got a lot of questions here, sorry, they're all coming out at once, but do you also feel like it's your responsibility to tell other people so that if something like this has happened to them, they don't feel completely insane?
Yeah, you know, like I had a patient who was having a special surgery, which I talk about in my book, The Frozen Man. In that case, we could not put the patient on a bypass pump for some time, so we literally froze him. There was no blood going through his brain for about 45 minutes. And that patient was describing out-of-body experience and what was happening in the operating room. And I thought this patient is hallucinating because there was no blood going through his brain for 45 minutes. I actually went ahead and gave him an antipsychotic medication shot of Haldol to make him go to sleep, and I told him I'll come next day to talk to him, but I never went. So, you know, by definition, spiritual experiences are very subjective experiences, and it cannot be proven either way. You know, like, is there God or there's no God? You can't do a lab experiment to prove it. So near-death experience or any spiritual experience can be known by the effect it has on the person. You know, regular dreams or hallucinations do not cause a profound change in the person, but near-death experience like Anita Morjani, Eben Alexander, they were profoundly changed after their near-death experience.
Yeah, healed in a way too. Are you like that too? Are you free of cancer?
Yeah, I'm free of cancer, yeah. And I used to suffer from depression, that got better, and all things got better. And now it's my mission to help people and tell my story that there is something beyond just living for materialistically, to live for a higher purpose, and that higher purpose could be anything. You know, taking care of, thinking that it is God or spirit, or if somebody does not believe in God or spirit, it could be preventing child abuse, child pornography, or, you know, anything, nature, or anything higher than your own self.
So live with some type of purpose to yourself. And is that regardless of whether or not you have a near-death experience?
Oh, yeah. When I talk, I usually say that you don't have to have a near-death experience to transform. You can transform right now. And my three things are prayer, service, and meditation. And other mantra I talk about is forgive, love, and heal. because that's very important. You know, forgiveness is not for making the wrong action right or condoning the action, but it is for your own sake. And forgiveness, I talk about, is at four levels. One is forgiving people who wronged you. Second is asking for forgiveness from people who you hurt. And the third is forgiving your own self for hurting others, and forgiving your own self for hurting yourself. And I find the last two to be the most difficult.
That, could, yeah. Yeah. You could really spend a lifetime just doing those things.
Yeah.
Going through your whole life. Did you... Hang on. Let me stop for a second and take a breath. The one thing I wanted to ask you is, it seems to me like the medical world needs you back with this newfound empathy. It seems like you would be the best anesthesiologist and doctor ever, because you're actually hearing people now and hearing what they're saying to you and so forth. Have you ever thought of, or have you gone back to being a doctor in the capacity that you were before?
I've not gone back, but sometimes what you're saying, I feel that, you know. But now I feel to be more helping people at the spiritual level, because I feel the wellness is at four levels: physical, mental, social or heart, and spiritual. So the root cause is usually, like especially with addiction and depression, is trauma, some core wounding. And in my work, this core wounding could be from previous life, from childhood, or from adulthood, or even there's something known as family constellation, where the grandfather had suffered during Holocaust, and now the grandchild who never met the grandfather is showing those symptoms. So instead of just, for me, depression and addiction are symptoms, not the cause.
Does anybody ever describe you as so brave? Because to make all of the changes that you've made, and to have that moment where you say, okay, I'm going to write a book about this, I'm going to talk about this openly, what happened, yep, I may get some pushback, all these things. Does anybody ever call you brave?
Yeah.
Courageous?
Courageous. I don't remember reading the word brave, but I, in the reviews, and you know, people call me very courageous, and I actually am very lucky, because my wife supported me in all these changes. You know, after all, it was her house too. It's not just my house. You know, the lifestyle changes. And, you know, we had to make compromises. You know, like I drive a Toyota Camry hybrid, and so my life literally went from Hummer to hybrid, you know, figuratively and literally. But she didn't have the near-death experience, so she didn't have the deep transformation, so she still drives an expensive car. You know, and
you would both hate one of our cars. We literally have nicknamed one of our cars the French Fry Mobile.
Really?
It's this white Toyota Sienna minivan. It's like from 2004, but we are having the worst time getting rid of it because it's raised our four teenage boys. And now we have two boys in college, another one who's a senior and another one who's a freshman. It still has like little kid stickers in the window and everything.
We're
having the worst. The kids are like, please stop driving this one. No, love this car.
Yeah.
The kids are like, it's embarrassing. It's funny.
I can see we had a Suburban like that one time,
They're hard to get
actually,
rid of.
We had a van, a Dodge Caravan, and then we bought Suburban, my kids were small. I have three kids,
Are
in college.
That's so cool. That kids are the coolest thing. What do they think? They must be happy that you're alive and well.
They're happy and alive. You know, I have two sons. You know, eldest is 28, 29, and then I have a daughter who's going to dental school in L.A., and then youngest is doing engineering in San Diego. And my boys are like the new dad, but they are kind of agnostic, you know. But they like when the new dad, who's more tolerable, who's more friendly, more accepting, much happier in life. My wife and my daughter, was skeptical in the beginning, but as I changed and as the things changed, and then they started accepting it more and more. Because one of the definitions I remember from Deepak Chopra, how are you advancing in your life, is how synchronicities happen in your life. In my life, there were a lot of synchronicities. Suddenly, my house got sold, and I got this book, co-author, and now the book became a bestseller, which was beyond my wildest dream. So one thing I just do want to emphasize before we finish, that there are divine beings, like I met angels, Michael and Raphael, who are there to help us for asking. And right now I feel and I pray to, I don't pray to angels, you don't pray to angels, only God deserves the prayer. But I ask for help from Angel Gabriel, who's making this communication, speaking, and book doing so good to all possible.
I believe in angels. I think they're everywhere. I can't explain it yet or anything like that, but I just, I don't know, people seem like they're angels even. It's
yeah.
I don't have words for it. I can't articulate it, but it seems like every once in a while you meet a real-life angel, and it's the strangest thing, and you may feel like you've known them forever, and I don't know, I believe in angels.
Yeah, and they show up, you know, like 2 days ago I was in Denver giving a speech, and it was a small workshop, and I was talking about Angel Gabriel, and I kept looking at one person, you know, for some reason I was being attracted to him again and again, and after the talk, he comes up to me and says, you know, my name is Gabriel.
Huh. Yeah, see, that kind of stuff. It's just such a coincidence and such a it's like a soul thing. I'm doing my own homework and trying to figure it out as I go here, too. And I think that's sort of what it's all about. Can you stay for just like 5 more minutes? I can ask you just two more questions.
Sure.
What I want to ask you is, first of all, is there anything I haven't asked you that you wanted to say?
You know, like what my conclusion was versus forgive, love, and heal. And you can transform right now with a practice of service, which I call seva, meditation, and prayer. And then there were the 7 eternal truths, which I realized from parts of my journey, like first, consciousness can exist outside the body. There's life after death. When I met my father, from my past life experience, we have past lives and future lives, especially the past lives affect us. When I met the angels, that there are divine beings who are there to help us, ascended masters. And then we all are connected to each other. So you and me are connected, we made of the same thing. And the other one was, there are different levels of consciousness. And one of the way I talk about consciousness-based healing is to increase your vibrations and level of consciousness, and the things which are not serving you will fall away. And, you know, by meditation and prayer. And the last is, the pure nature of reality is ultimately unconditional love and intelligence, which I call my near-death manifesto.
Yeah, I love that in your book, all of those what did you call them again? There's 7.
Eternal truths.
Yeah, I loved your explanations of everything there. And can you explain what a light shout is? What's a light shout?
You know, light shout,
right?
Yeah, is a way of meditation where you imagine you are in the presence of the light being, and that's I call a light being, other name I give it is a light being meditation. Like during my workshops, I take people on what I call in the presence of the light. It's basically a visualization exercise. And that light shout, or light, being in presence of the light, is very healing. And when they leave their body, they remain connected to the body and to the earth with a silver cord. So I do want to make sure they come back. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you ever think maybe you're an angel?
I communicate with angels, but I never thought that way.
Like maybe you're the angel?
Yeah. Could,
could be. You never know.
Yeah,
you're
there
touching
are
a lot
angels
of lives.
Yeah, earth angels, yeah.
Heart angel.
Yeah.
Anyway, all right. Well, I just wondered if maybe you thought that way, because I'm sure, I bet as time goes on, people will maybe think that about you.
Yeah.
I bet somebody will say
but
that.
But, you know, my aim is
point.
To serve, you know, like, that's why I like your title, you know. Somebody reminded me of, I was in Montreal 3 weeks ago, and somebody asked me in public, how do I prepare for my my death? And answer spontaneously came to me. It was a panel that you prepare for your death by living this life fully in service of others.
That's true. Very, very, very true. I don't want to keep you longer than promised, we goofed up the time, so I apologize for that.
Okay.
And yeah,
no,
but thank
okay.
you. I hope that maybe you'll join us again. It's been very interesting to talk with you.
Sure,
and I appreciate
anytime,
your time.
You know, after a few months.
Yeah, absolutely. And so your book is called Dying to Wake Up. Your website is Dying to Wake Up, and people can reach you via your website, Facebook, Twitter. I will post a big blog and link to the radio show and your book and all that good stuff. When we're done here, and just thank you, and I'm glad you're here, and I'm glad you're doing what you're doing. I think it's very special, and so give your family giant hugs for being so cool.
Oh, sure. Okay.
All right, take care of yourself. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, everybody,
bye.
For listening, too. All right, take care. Thank you for listening, and please visit us at besteveryou.com. If you get a chance, we'll go ahead and post this interview and post links to his book and all that good stuff, and I just really appreciate you joining us for the first Best Ever You show of the new season. So thank you, everybody, and have a wonderful day.
Thank you for listening to the Best Ever You Network. For more information, just visit us at besteveryou.com.